First case on our docket is Moffett versus Life Care Centers. I want to inform the parties that Justice Bender is not participating in this case. So we are ready to hear from the petitioner.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is John Holland, number 5246, and I'm appearing here today along with Anna Holland Edwards and Erica Grossman. We both all represent the petitioners James Moffett and Roseanne O'Brien. We will be splitting the argument this morning. I will be handling the question why general powers of attorney cannot sign arbitration agreements for incapacitated persons under the HCAA. And Anna Holland Edwards will be addressing why the decision to arbitrate is a legal decision, not a medical one under the HCAA in Colorado. And also why the Court of Appeals, we believe, erroneously substituted its judgment for the proper finding of the trial court that the healthcare facility had illegally conditioned the admission or stay of Mrs. Moffett on signing an arbitration agreement. Try to save a few minutes for rebuttal. This case involves a claim arising out of the death of Dorothy Moffett from dehydration. At the time she came to the Life Care Briarwood facility, Mrs. Moffett was a stroke victim who was suffering from profound dementia to everyone's knowledge. Her son was told that one of the papers he had to sign in order for his mother to continue to stay was an arbitration agreement, and she would not be allowed to stay if he did not. As this court explained, I think there are three basic points for argument, one from my standpoint. As this court explained in Allen v. Pacheco and Colorado Permanente Medical Group v. Evans, the HCAA in 401 sets as a general firm goal for this statute that arbitration agreements be voluntary ones between the patient and the healthcare facility. The patient in this act, while it has a few exceptions as to what it might mean that I will discuss, means the person receiving healthcare. In furtherance of this basic goal, which this court has spoken to twice and recognized twice, the HCA in Section 11 prohibits submitting an arbitration agreement to an incapacitated person who lacks rational capacity to decide whether to sign. In Health One versus Rodriguez, this court was, as opposing counsel in this case, there persuasively argued to this court the protective provisions regarding incapacitated people under the HCAA apply equally to their legal representatives. The Court of Appeals, notwithstanding Rodriguez and despite its citation, nonetheless held that a mere power of attorney could exercise the decision-making for an incapacitated person under Section 11. In Rodriguez, I think perhaps the most important point to me about Rodriguez is that you had in front of you Mrs. Rodriguez, who was a conservator and a wife of the person wanting to elect the lump sum. Yet, the court held because the protective provisions of the HCAA with respect to incapacitated people did not provide for surrogates to act, she could not make the election of a lump sum.
Mr. Holland?
Yes, sir.
The statutory language that we looked at in Health One versus Rodriguez is a bit different than the language we're looking at here.
Would you care to
contrast it, please?
Well, I would say this. If you look at the definition of incapacitated, Your Honor, that is imported into the lump sum statute, and generally, it includes people who lack the ability to make rational decisions. So what I see in the wording, while the legislature in 11 did not use the word incapacitated, which it might have, it used the language of its definition of incapacitated, at least a section of the definition, which includes people who lack the capacity to rationally decide. So I think that That inability to decide is an incapacitated person within the meaning of the Act under Section 11.
Well, the contrast, Mr. Holland, that I was interested in was less the one that you just focused on, and more the language of 11, which is that the agreement may not be submitted to the patient, as opposed to prohibiting the agreement, which I think would be language more similar to that in Health One versus Rodriguez. Do you agree with that, or do you see that there is no substantial difference in that respect?
I think that it's a protective, the way I see Rodriguez is you were talking about the protective provision of the Act. And you kept mentioning, or you talked about, as you have in Evans and in Pacheco, about the protective purposes of the Act. The protective purpose of the Act in this section is to prevent people from overreaching and preying upon people not in a position to decide whether they wish to volunteer. We know in the HCAA that if the legislature wants someone to be able to act for someone else, they know how to do it because we have three good examples. A parent may elect for a child. Since the amendments of the HCAA after Rodriguez, people who fit the statutory definition of judicially appointed fiduciaries may elect a lump sum. If the legislature had wanted, to include the third example, it's one of the most interesting provisions of the HCAA that I think bears on this one is it's if a person voluntarily comes into a healthcare facility capacitated with the ability to decide that they want to contract for arbitration, but then becomes incapacitated, the statute has a provision in 5 to specifically allow rescission by a guardian or a conservator. So that, we think, reemphasizes the legislative intent that only a patient adult with capacity can sign. The legislature knows how to change this if it wants to. And after Healthcare One, Rodriguez, they came back and only narrowly changed the lump sum section, but didn't change the definition. If they wanted incapacity to mean something other than what this court thought it meant in Rodriguez, they could have changed the definition to permit surrogates to act wherever incapacitated persons were specified, but they didn't do that. They didn't even touch Section 11, which, if you look at its legislative history, was clearly something they were concerned about. They were concerned about protecting the right to civil jury trial against predation and overreaching and assuring that it be voluntary.
Counsel, could I stop you there? Here on the end.
I'm sorry. I think the reason I thought it was Justice Malarkey.
I think respondent will stand up and argue, isn't that section really designed to keep you from approaching someone who's incapacitated and asking them, here, sign this, and they don't understand that. And isn't, again, just to make their argument, isn't that the purpose of the statute? And that was satisfied here because they didn't approach the patient. They went directly to the person with the power of attorney.
I think that, and full respect, I don't think that makes any sense. They weren't engaging in wishful thinking here. They don't need to say don't contract with the incapacitated. We all should know that, right? That's what our law is about. What generally speaking, you can't contract with an incapacitated person. Many a time in my own work in this area, I have to serve. A statute will require me to serve a person who lacks capacity. For example, a petition for approval of a personal injury settlement. The idea that it doesn't make sense, what I think the legislature was doing is what I think Justice Holmes was indicating in the language we put in the brief about, we see what you're driving at. The legislature intended not to allow people to go behind an incapacitated person, but to prohibit protectively attempting to contract away the rights of patients to engage in lawsuits for injuries where they couldn't volunteer, because the key provision is one, voluntariness. And 11 is an implementation of voluntariness. Don't mess with the incapacitated. Why would you say, don't mess with the incapacitated, mess with their surrogates, without specifying the surrogate when it's easy to specify the surrogate and you didn't do so, and you held in Rodriguez that it's easy to do so, and if you don't do so, you can't do it.
But so your argument essentially is that having the ability to for a patient to sue is essentially so important that if you're incapacitated, we're not going to let anyone else do that for you on your behalf.
As a entry into a healthcare treatment model, it's a protective prohibition. It was designed to protect voluntariness, and it's a limitation on the power of the facility. And what the Court of Appeals has done is eviscerate that section. Because you can't envision, I don't think, Justice Hyde, an example where it would work out that they couldn't ignore 11. So why have 11 there at all? 11 has no meaning if you can drive a Mack truck through it.
Well, I don't quite understand the setting, though. And you know, we have to look at all the statutes that may apply, and certainly a lot of powers are given through the power of attorney and the health care power of attorney, I'm going to call it just for purposes of this question,
right,
including not sustaining life, including going into the financial resources of the person who's incapacitated and making payments, making contracts, acting for that person. Now, why does it make sense, since arbitration in this state has a preferred status? I mean, that is, we our law and our statutes, our case law do favor it. Why in the world would the legislature not allow someone who was fully conscious to and empowered to make decisions for a person that's incapacitated be prohibited from electing arbitration over litigation? Well, I don't understand the policy argument you're making.
I think that's kind of the question you could have asked in Rodriguez, too. Why couldn't Mrs. Rodriguez elect a lump sum to benefit her husband?
Because of a specific provision that addressed that issue.
Interpreted to include the general power of conservatorship, which is an extremely broad fiduciary power.
I don't think you've answered my question. Okay. Why would the power of attorneys, those two provisions, not be read in conjunction with this statute to see what the legislature's meaning regarding the agency relationship is?
Okay. Well, I think, frankly, what I think is that the HCAA has delimited and limited the powers of certain kinds of fiduciaries in several respects. It does not allow any number of types of fiduciaries to act. For example, a spouse could not just sign an arbitration agreement because if they didn't have a general power of attorney. There are limitations, but people do that sort of thing. Next friend and power of attorney are the most common. But the power of attorney statute currently, as worded, does not even allow the general power of attorney to elect pre-dispute arbitration on its face. If you look at 15.14.726.1, it says that a general power of attorney can only elect as to a claim already existing. The HCAA reaches pre-dispute arbitration. It is about not conditioning healthcare on agreeing to enter an arbitration agreement. It is not about subsequent proceedings after a person has been injured. So the bottom line is, while the general power of attorney statute has lots of general powers, the HCAA limits powers. And the HCAA is a policy about arbitration, and it has substantive and procedural safeguards which can coexist and are not at war with the general policy of the state in favor of arbitration. We have been miscast as opposing arbitration. We are not opposed to arbitration. I've done arbitration, I've been in arbitration. Arbitration, there are two policies. And in two states that have abolished nursing home arbitration, there's a general policy for arbitration. And in the many court decisions we've cited to you, Your Honor, you will see courts struggling to coalesce the two policies. Here you have a specific statute that has requirements, procedural and substantive, for entry into an arbitration agreement. All we're asking this court to do is what it did in Evans and Pacheco, which is enforce the terms of the statute. We're not speaking against arbitration. You can have arbitration if you comply. They're not at war.
Well, it seemed like the General Assembly, in all due respect, had a provision that made it clear that you didn't have to enter into the arbitration to get the medical treatment, and it's right there on the face in bold type.
Right.
And it would seem that, you know, an empowered person to act for the incapacitated person is on knowledge and has a fiduciary duty and can consider arbitration versus litigation and basically make that choice. Now, isn't that a permissible construction of this whole legislative design?
I think it eviscerates Section 11 with all due respect.
What you're reading to say that no incapacitated service. Person or any person acting for an incapacitated person may agree to arbitration.
Just as in Rodriguez, it includes the surrogates. If the legislature wanted surrogates to act for the lump sum, it could have specified. It did not. Here it has not. Still, therefore, Rodriguez controls in relationship to Section 1. The legislature knows how to specify for surrogates. It did not. Go ahead, Your Honor.
Before you sit down. You were making a point on Section 5 that I'm not sure I grasp. Could you recap that?
Okay. The arbitration provision, that section permits for rescission by a conservator and by a guardian of someone who presumably volunteered for an arbitration agreement and then lost capacity during the statutory period for rescission. And so I'm saying it reinforces the legislative intent that for adults, you have to have a voluntary agreement.
And I don't see that, because it says written notice may be given by a guardian of the patient if the patient is
incapacitated. And has signed, they've already seen, because the statute creates a rescission right.
It doesn't say that the patient became incapacitated.
No, it doesn't, but I think that's the fair reading. I think the reading is that they're acting for someone who signed one.
But Mr. Hall, just while you're on that, assuming that you're right about that, that it's right. About someone becoming incapacitated, it doesn't invalidate the agreement or require the conservator or the guardian to rescind the agreement.
No.
So it apparently permits the guardian or the conservator to decide not to rescind and to proceed with the arbitration agreement, which seems inconsistent with your reading of, at least in terms of the spirit of Section 11, that is, you say Section 11 prohibits such an agreement.
No, because that situation envisions that the agreement was already voluntary. The rescission capability assumes that the arbitration provision was signed by a capacitated person, that is, the patient, but that the legislature anticipated in the 90-day rescission period there could arise a circumstance of sudden incapacity where there was still time to rescind, so they authorized high-level fiduciaries to rescind. That also, if you read the statute of pari materia, the only fiduciaries allowed to act throughout the statute are judicially appointed ones. I need to defer to Ms. Holland Edwards, Your Honors. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Bar number 35811. The Healthcare Availability Act at Section 4037 makes it unlawful to condition care on the signing of an arbitration agreement. In Colorado, medical powers of attorney may only make medical treatment decisions by statute. The decision whether or not to enter into an arbitration agreement can never be a medical treatment decision because nothing medically related can hinge on the outcome of that decision. Therefore, medical powers of attorney in Colorado are not empowered to sign away the right to a jury trial on behalf of their principal. The Court of Appeals, in concluding otherwise below, adopted case law from a series of other jurisdictions with very different statutory schemes. Specifically, the Owens decision by the Tennessee Supreme Court found that medical surrogates in Tennessee may properly enter into an arbitration agreement because in Tennessee, that may be necessary to obtain medical care. In Colorado, it can never be necessary to obtain medical care. It's illegal to make it necessary to obtain medical care. So those powers do not need to be extended to medical surrogates.
Can I stop you there, counsel? But you say it can never be necessary, but it is something that can occur before medical care is given. Is that correct? And I mean, if you take that line of argument, can you help me understand why it is not a medical care decision?
It's true that that the legislature of Colorado allows for arbitration agreements that comply with HCAA in the medical context. But there are many agreements that are allowed and that may precede a medical decision that don't just magically become medical decisions because they're placed in a train of documents along with medical decisions. The example we gave in our brief was a medical power of attorney cannot sell your house to pay for your health care. It may be something that would further medical care, but it is outside of the power given to medical powers of attorney who are only allowed to make medical treatment decisions. There are ancillary powers that might have to be given or might have to be acknowledged on behalf of a medical power of attorney. For example, medical power of attorney clearly must be allowed to sign an informed consent because a medical power of attorney can make surgical decisions. If they were not allowed to sign the informed consent, it could impact negatively their ability to effectuate their medical treatment decision. The arbitration decision is not like that. It can't, if they don't arbitrate, if they don't agree to arbitrate, if they're not allowed to by statute, there are no medical treatment decisions that they are unable to make because of that lack of power. It doesn't impact the medical care given to the principal. And so it is an unreasonable expansion of the plain language of the statute to grant them powers that could be arguably related to medicine, but that aren't necessary to effectuate their medical treatment decisions. The plain reading of the Medical Treatment Act, which defines the powers given to medical treatment, to medical powers of attorney, underscores this. There's a requirement at 1514.5063 that medical powers of attorney confer with the doctor for the principal before making medical treatment decisions. This underscores the reading that the types of decisions that are to be made here are medical, whether to have antibiotics, whether to have surgery, whether to withhold life support. Those are medical decisions. Whether or not to waive a jury trial in Colorado has nothing to do with your medical care because it's illegal to tie the two together.
So it seems to me you've got an argument that this is a continuum of decision making, and that on one end you have something that is clearly a medical decision, and you would say the medical power of attorney would apply. I suppose it would be something like following the doctor's advice to give a certain medication, something like that. And then on the other end, you have the sale of the house, which you see as totally outside the powers of a someone who holds that type of appointment. So it looks like your argument then gets into the big gray area, and you've decided that the arbitration clause falls on outside the powers. How would we figure that out? How do we know what is closely enough related to the medical issues and when the power it goes over into the other end of the continuum?
Your Honor, I think that the position put forward by defendants that any decision that relates to medical care invites the exact type of ambiguity you're talking about in this concern about a continuum, because relates to is such a broad term that is not found anywhere in the statute. What we're arguing should happen is what the bulk of courts across the country have done. Medical decisions that are clearly medical can be made by medical powers of attorney, and those that are necessary to make those decisions, not those that are related, where we have to look at, well, how related is this? You know, I can say healthcare near it. Is that related enough? I think that the line has to be, do I have to be able to make this decision in order to effectuate the medical treatment care options that I want for my principal? And if it's necessary, I must be able to, because otherwise it would negatively impact my ability to act.
Well, that doesn't quite help us, though, does it? Because it might be necessary to sell the house to pay for the medical treatment. So necessary is, again, a difficult word.
I guess legally necessary is what I'm talking about.
So tell me what the difference is between necessary and legally necessary, if you don't mind.
I think that the informed consent is the best example I've come up with, is something that we say that doctors can require informed consent to have a surgery, and so that is a legal requirement. It's not too onerous to require that, and so that is a decision that must be allowed to be entered. There are some more basic and less important contracts, like signing the admissions agreement to a facility. If you've chosen a facility, that's necessary. We allow that to happen. But where something is not allowed to impact medical care, like arbitration, there's no reason to grant these greatly expanded powers of legal jury trial rights to legal powers of attorney. As I see my time's waning, I've turned to the third issue if there's no further questions.
Well, I do have a further question because with regard to the Chief Justice's question, when she talked about the continuum, I just want to, and this will probably tie into your third issue. Are we supposed to assume that there was a power of attorney and the medical power of attorney in this case, and that those two instruments, if they were in the record, fully reflect all the powers given under both statutes?
Your Honor, we've conceded that there are powers of attorney of some type in this case. We don't know the content, and it's our position that the content doesn't matter because the statutes don't allow either type.
I understand that.
But
the question is, are we supposed to assume for this argument on the law, which is what you're advancing here, that there are two instruments here governing the ability of an agent to make decisions in this continuum that under the power of attorney statute would include filing lawsuits, right? Financial matters bridging all the way to the medical treatment. Is that what we're supposed to assume?
If this court were to decide that some types of powers of attorney could enter into arbitration, I don't think it would be...
Or disclaim the right to file a lawsuit in favor of going the arbitration route.
Well, it's our position that the HCAA arbitration provision is with respect to pre-dispute arbitration. But if you were to find that some powers of attorney were authorized to enter into those decisions, I think you would need the content of those powers of attorney in front of you, and that would be, at the trial court level, the responsibility of defendants. However, the third question here is whether the trial court's determination that this care was in fact conditioned on the obtaining of an arbitration agreement should be respected. That decision made by Judge Rappaport and clearly made in the record was supported by the evidence, is not clearly erroneous, and invalidates this agreement and should have been respected by the Court of Appeals, and we respectfully request that the Court of Appeals decision be overturned.
Now, let me ask you this, though. She didn't take any evidence on this issue. There was an affidavit submitted. Apparently the affidavit would concede that the person who made it had these powers of attorney that we're talking about, and is simply alleging that despite the fact that he exercised those powers, the Health Care Act prohibits it. And the Court of Appeals apparently wanted more of a factual basis because it could be that the judge basically agreed with the legal argument that only the patient herself or himself can enter into an arbitration agreement. Isn't that kind of the problem that the Court of Appeals put its finger on?
The Court of Appeals did think that more information was needed with respect to that issue. However, ignored the fact that the trial court specifically stated, I do find as a matter of fact, that care was conditioned here. And that factual finding was supported by the evidence in the form of an affidavit and was exactly as this court has required in J.A. Walker and should be upheld and should not have been told by the Court of Appeals to revisit. I will reserve the rest of our time for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court and counsel, I am Ron Nemiro of Kennedy, Childs & Fogg. My number is 15178. And I'm appearing here on behalf of the appellant, Life Care Centers, doing business as Briarwood Healthcare Center. This court has granted certiorari on three issues. One, whether holders of powers of attorney may enter and have the authority to execute arbitration agreements for incapacitated long-term patients. We think they do. Two, whether holders of durable medical powers of attorney have authority to execute those agreements. We think they do. And three, whether the Court of Appeals impermissibly usurped the fact-finding function of the trial court in remanding the case to the trial court for further fact-finding. To go into whether Mr. Moffitt was coerced into signing the arbitration agreement and whether he stayed coerced for 90 days afterwards. We don't think that the Court of Appeals did usurp the trial court's function. The first two issues implicate this state's decided public policy favoring arbitration. The third issue is, at bottom, a straightforward standard of review issue, which this court has dealt with before. I will address each issue in order.
But before you take the first two issues in order, could I just ask you to sort of clarify for me what the relationship between these two issues is?
The relationship between the medical durable power of attorney and...
Right, right.
And the durable power of attorney. It strikes me there's an overlap. I guess the issue is, what is the distinction between a medical durable power of attorney and a durable power of attorney? And may a medical durable power of attorney in and of itself sign an arbitration agreement on behalf of an incapacitated patient?
And the reason I ask that is, if we've been talking about whether, you know, that signing the arbitration agreement would fit within the powers of a medical durable power of attorney, and I'm a little curious about why, what the significance of that is. Does that want to suggest that even if a power of attorney would not allow the power of attorney to act on behalf of the principal if the principal is incapacitated, which I take it is the argument here on the part of your opponents, is the suggestion that a medical durable power of attorney would?
Yes, to be blunt. Here, this is the sort of issue, this is the sort of decision which comes within, we would urge, the ambit of both a durable power of attorney and a medical durable power of attorney. Or it wouldn't come into the ambit at all of a power of attorney that wasn't durable.
And perhaps then, as you address the question whether the power of attorney could act on behalf of the principal with regard to this situation, maybe you could address why you're about ready to say why a power of attorney could act, and this statute was not intended to prohibit the power of attorney from acting on behalf of an incapacitated person. Maybe you could explain why that wouldn't apply in the same way to a medical durable power of attorney.
Well,
if that's true, then why do we need to worry about whether a medical durable power of attorney would include signing an arbitration agreement?
If you're asking, if this court decides that the durable power of attorney alone can sign an arbitration agreement for an incapacitated patient, this court need not get to the second issue, if that's what you're driving at.
Okay.
If there's some question as to what the contents of the power of attorney which plaintiffs alleged existed were, then this court, we would ask, get to that issue, because they've also alleged the existence of a medical durable power of attorney. Justice Hobbs asked earlier, where are we to assume the contents are? The answer to that would have two prongs. First, we take the position that plaintiffs are stopped from denying that they had authority to enter into the agreements that Mr. Moffitt entered into. And because they've taken that position in the courts below, and because they signed the arbitration agreement and the admission agreement under the authority of the durable powers of attorney and the medical durable powers of attorney. If that position is rejected...
In what pleadings or context does that appear?
It appears in the complaint,
yeah,
and it appears in the pleading, in the motions for summary judgment, where the plaintiffs say there's no disputed issues of fact. And it also, I think those are the two places.
Okay. And we're to assume that these are the full authorities, there was no limitation in these?
That's what I would urge the court, that's the position I would urge the court.
And it would pick up this durable power of attorney statute that refers specifically to the ability to submit to arbitration.
The durable power of attorney statute does,
right,
refer specifically.
It specifically addresses arbitration.
Right. And because it's a durable power of attorney, and because a durable power of attorney survives the incapacitation of the principal, it would seem to go without saying that arbitration agreements can be entered on behalf of incapacitated principals. The question remaining then is, can that happen in a healthcare context?
Right.
And that question is addressed in the Healthcare Availability Act. The Healthcare Availability Act sets forth the requirements for an arbitration agreement. And that would be, the fact that it does so is consistent with the public policy of the state as set forth in the Constitution. And the state is one of only three states that have that in its constitution. And it's consistent with the many decisions of this court implementing, recognizing, and advancing the public policy favoring arbitration. So therefore, the question isn't, does The Healthcare Availability Act prohibited arbitration agreements on behalf of incapacitated patients. It is, how can it prohibit it? It would have to be contrary to the public policy. And if it was contrary to the public policy, it would have to be done quite clearly. And none of the provisions, none of the three provisions that plaintiffs point to, clearly prohibit arbitration agreements on behalf of incapacitated patients. Let me go over them one by one. The first one is in the first paragraph of the statute, and that's the one that requires that arbitration agreements be voluntary agreements between a healthcare provider and a patient. This court, has, in the Colorado Permanente case, has already interpreted that language. Not to suggest you don't remember the case, but in that case, a HMO proposed that it was not subject to the requirements, the format and language requirements of the Healthcare Availability Act, because it was not a healthcare provider. It was an HMO. This court, affirming the Court of Appeals, said, not so fast. That language doesn't restrict the ambit of the statute. It requires that arbitration agreements be voluntary. It doesn't restrict them to healthcare providers and patients. So just as an HMO couldn't say it doesn't have to comply with the language and format requirements of the Act, we couldn't say that either. We can't get out of complying with those requirements because the Healthcare Availability Act was signed by a power of attorney. Plaintiffs don't say that we failed to comply with the format and language requirements of the Act. They say that we failed to comply with the Act in other ways. That is, in having it signed by a power of attorney at all. So we propose that the Colorado Permanente case resolves the first argument, the argument regarding Section 1 of 1514 of the Healthcare Availability Act. The second provision is Section 5, which says that a guardian or a conservator can rescind in writing arbitration agreements entered by others. And this language, this provision needs to be read in its entirety to be understood. It says, please forgive my recitation, once signed, the agreement shall govern all subsequent provision of medical services for which the agreement was signed until or unless rescinded by written notice. And here's where it matters. Written notice of such rescission may be given by a guardian or conservator of the patient if the patient is incapacitated or a minor. Where the agreement is one for medical services to a minor, it shall not be subject to disaffirmation by the minor if signed by the minor's parent or legal guardian. What this language addresses is the priority of who may rescind what agreements. This, for example, it says most forthrightly that conservators and guardians can rescind the agreement of a parent to arbitrate on behalf of a child. Otherwise, without this provision, that would be ambiguous. It would also say, and we adopt the position taken by the Colorado Hospital Association in its brief, that it resolves other ambiguities, for example, between a power of attorney and a conservator or a guardian.
Well, you heard Mr. Holland's argument, which is that the section doesn't come into play unless it's a situation where the patient had capacity and became incapacitated during the stay, I guess.
I heard that, and I agree with the skepticism expressed by the court that that language isn't in there. That this comes into play regarding any written arbitration agreement.
What about the last sentence in that, the one about minors? If the agreement is one for medical services for a minor, shall not be subject to disaffirmation by the minor if signed by the minor's parents or guardian. Doesn't that sound like that's contemplating one of these situations where the minor is no longer a minor?
No, I think not, because I would think that once a minor, always a minor until you're 18.
Yeah, but I mean, a minor cannot disaffirm a contract
right.
During his or her minority.
And this may be one of those statutes that sort of gild the lily.
It could also be that it supports Mr. Holland's argument that it's talking about a change of circumstances, since it has to be a minor who is now an adult to be able to disaffirm. And that would seem to follow Mr. Holland's argument that you have, in the first case, an adult with capacity who has become incapacitated.
That would be consistent with that interpretation, but it wouldn't be an exclusive interpretation of it. Just because it would support Mr. Holland's interpretation doesn't mean it would exclude other interpretations.
Oh, I certainly concede that, but it does show that there could be some drafting problems with this statute.
Well, there are many drafting problems with the statute. The statute, for example, Section 11, refers to signing, says that arbitration agreements should not be submitted to a patient who is incapable of making a rational decision. It might surprise no one that the legislature did not attempt to define what rational decision means. But rational decision is a very squishy concept. When you compare this language to the language that Justice Martinez pointed out in Rodriguez, there's worlds of differences between the drafting and worlds of differences, I suggest, between the intent. The Rodriguez statutory language talks about incapacitated persons, which is defined under the statute. It talks about plaintiffs, which needs no definition. That is how a statute gets its point across. Interestingly, in that statute, a parent cannot accept a lump sum payment on behalf of a child, and still cannot. If arbitration was the horror that plaintiffs suggest, and horror is a word from their reply brief, I believe, if the legislature was as reluctant to permit incapacitated persons' issues to be arbitrated as plaintiffs suggest, then the legislature could have drafted the provision much like it did in Rodriguez, holding particularly that plaintiffs who are incapacitated cannot have their cases arbitrated. That's language that means something. The submission, the Section 11 here talks about when an agreement may be submitted. It doesn't talk about when an agreement may be executed or entered.
Counselor, before you leave that point, can I just follow up with Chief Justice Mularkey's questions? Can you address the argument, though, that the language specifies conservators and guardians, but doesn't say power of attorney or any representative? Or isn't that potentially limiting language?
I think not, Your Honor. I mean, and this is why. The statute does not ever say that parents can enter arbitration agreements for the children. That goes without saying. The statute does say that minors can't disaffirm those agreements, but it's assumed that parents can enter those agreements. In the same way, it's assumed in this statute, as it is in so many statutes, that agents for principals can enter contracts for the principals.
If they have a fiduciary relationship and duty.
Right.
That arises. I mean, that's the context of differentiating just the parent and a fiduciary that's empowered by the person for whom the fiduciary is acting.
And right? I take your point that parents have, it's ironic, have less of a duty to their children as holders of powers of attorney have to their principals. And that being the case, the interpretation of the statute that plaintiffs advance doesn't make a lot of sense.
Now, the conservator, I mean, that's an interesting provision, because what it seems to say is, even though it was entered into by a fiduciary fully empowered to do so, that a conservator or a guardian can rescind it.
It is interesting, and I don't know the rationale behind it, but it's not for me to say. It's quite clear.
Well, it seems to be the legislature's pointing to special enhanced duties of the conservator or guardian is what I'm trying to figure, but it seems to be a provision, at least, that acts on a pre-existing agreement that was validly entered into. And there's no time period, is there?
No. And it seems also odd. It would seem to me, in the panoply of powers, that it would be that the highest power would be one that the patient has nominated himself. And it would be somewhere below that to have a court or an external authority designate a power. And that statute doesn't make sense from that standpoint, I admit.
Mr. Nemiro, just to explore the statute further, what would you say to the whether a power an attorney in fact could rescind pursuant to this statute?
Well, I think that in that the statute sets forth in detail the 90-day period, the 90-day sort of no risk, no questions asked period for rescission, I think that provides that an attorney in fact could rescind.
I think what about Section 5, which for an incapacitated person seems to leave that to only to the guardian or the conservator?
I read Section 5 to add to the people who can rescind, not to restrict the people who can rescind. And more to the point, it doesn't address who can enter the agreement. So Section 5, I think, is beside the point here, since Section 5 does not restrict who can enter an agreement. It addresses and adds to who can rescind one. An ancillary point here is the second issue on which the court granted certiorari, and that is on the powers of a medical durable power of attorney. And as pointed out, that would be moot if the durable power of attorney here is found to be sufficient. The issue here is when does a decision become a medical treatment decision and when is it a legal decision? And is there a line between them? Is there an overlap? The example that they give, the example of selling a house, is not the easy example that they suppose. And Justice Rice's question goes right to the point. It's not, and it's not an unusual issue either. The idea of making a claim under a health insurance policy, that notion would seem to fall squarely in both camps as both a legal decision and a medical treatment decision. And yet, it's not necessary, by their criterion, to the provision of medical treatments. It is a strictly legal act to make a claim under a policy. There is no healthcare provider on the other end. And yet, it would be crippling to medical durable powers of attorney if they can't make claims under healthcare policies.
Mr. Nemiro, maybe to ask you sort of the same question that was put to Ms. Holland Edwards. What is the test that you would define? How would you describe how we would determine whether something falls within that power or not?
Well, I think that she was right in saying that it's always a question of degree. But I think that the wiser course is the course taken by the Owens Court, the Tennessee Supreme Court, which is about medical treatment. I would say that selling a house may not be a medical treatment unless it's putting a lien on the house is necessary to get the treatment that the patient needs. So there will always be this gray area. But what the point of the Owens Court was, the point of the Tennessee decision was, is the clearer the distinction, the finer the line, the more problems you create. I think the law has to recognize overlap, so that there will be areas that are subject both to a durable power of attorney and a medical durable power of attorney. I don't see that this one, though, is a hard area. The decision to arbitrate medical treatment disputes seems to clearly relate to, and affect medical treatment. And it's not just demands.
How is that? Would you explain that? I'm having a little bit of trouble with that statement.
Well, there could be medical disputes that have nothing to do with claims. There could be medical disputes involving types of treatment or placement.
But the decision to pick the nursing home or not, let's say that.
The decision to pick a nursing home or not seems clearly to be a medical treatment decision and a legal decision.
And so you're saying that this arbitration versus preservation of litigation in case there's mistreatment is tied up in that bundle of picking the nursing home.
I think it is. I think that you can see the strange contortions plaintiffs have to enter when you consider that the cases that plaintiffs subscribe to say that an arbitration agreement, if it's contained within an admissions agreement, is a medical treatment decision. If you take the very same arbitration agreement and you move it, and you take it out of the arbitration agreement, out of the admission agreement, suddenly it's a legal decision. God help us if you should take that arbitration agreement and call it a supplement to or an amendment to the admissions agreement. There'd be no telling what the plaintiffs would say under those circumstances.
Could you remind me of the facts in this case? I don't recall the length of time that went on with the admission of the patient and the ultimate transfer of the patient to the hospital and for death.
The record shows that the patient was admitted to Briarwood 2 days before Mr. Moffitt signed the admissions agreement.
Okay.
The admissions agreement and the arbitration agreement are separate, so that the admissions agreement does not depend on the arbitration agreement.
Oh, I see you're saying two different documents.
Yeah, it's a standalone arbitration agreement. And Ms. Moffitt died at the hospital later. I don't remember that.
Well, I was just wondering, because we have this 90 days for rescission, I was trying to figure out how, that hasn't been raised as an issue here, but I assume that the death was after 90 days?
I think so. There's nothing, but it's an interesting point, because there's nothing in the statute that says that after a patient dies, the right of rescission expires with the patient. So that under Colorado statute, and it happens with some frequency, only one to a patient, but the patient dies within the 90 days, and technically the arbitration agreement can be rescinded. Colorado, as far as I know, is the most stringent of any state in that respect. None of the cases that either side has cited has a 90-day, no questions asked rescission period, and that's statutorily mandated by the Health Care Availability Act. And that's one of the safeguards.
Counsel, before you move on, can I get you to address directly the argument that how can this be a medical decision when there's a statutory expression saying that medical treatment cannot be dependent on or conditioned on signing an arbitration agreement? Basically, that there's a stated public policy that medical treatment cannot be conditioned on signing this agreement. So how can it be related or necessary to treatment?
Their reading of the medical durable power of attorney statute puts in the word necessary. That word is nowhere found in the statute. A medical treatment decision is one that relates to medical treatment. To say that it has to be necessary to medical treatment makes things very complicated, because does that mean that the medical durable power of attorney does not have the authority to pick out the payment plan, or what room the patient is placed in, or the ancillary details to medical treatment? So the word necessary is just not an element in the statute. And it's hard to know what is necessary to medical treatment once you make that distinction.
This is even more difficult. I mean, the test that you propose, where you have a situation where the validity of a lien could depend upon the powers of the medical power of attorney give. In turn, that depends upon the financial status of the patient relative to the health care that's being that is necessary or requested. That seems extraordinarily difficult as a real property issue.
It may be difficult, but I think it's no more. You would still have that problem under the necessary language that plaintiffs propose.
Forget about necessary, because I'm not sure that's the question that Justice Ide asked is really dependent upon the word necessary. Because it seems to me the suggestion that I'd like you to respond to is that by separating out the arbitration agreement, the legislature has essentially drawn that line for us and said arbitration agreements stand alone. They have nothing to do with whether health care will be provided or not. It's separate from obtaining this kind of care.
I take it as significant that the Health Care Availability Act itself provides for arbitration. And I invoke Justice Malarkey's concurrence in the Colorado Permanente case that finds that arbitration and the access to the ability to arbitrate cases is an intrinsic part of the Health Care Availability Act and the reform that it sought to institute. So to say that to separate the means for resolving disputes that arise from medical treatment from the arena of medical treatment is, I think, a very hard thing to do. Does that respond to your question?
So, thank you.
But it's clear that the General Assembly very explicitly wanted no coercion.
That's quite clear.
Involved with a selection between litigation and arbitration.
That's quite clear. And there can be no question about that. Whether there is coercion here is not clear in the record at all. Because as the record shows, Ms. Moffitt was in the residence for some days before Mr. Moffitt signed the arbitration agreement, for 2 days. And there was a 90-day right of rescission that Mr. Moffitt never took advantage of.
Yeah, but he was told he had to sign it, right, to keep her in the facility. I mean, that's at least the allegation.
That's the allegation.
So would you respond to that? I mean, why isn't the trial court justified in the absence of any other counter affidavit making a factual finding that, in fact, that representation was made to Mr. Moffitt?
For two reasons. First, because of the 90-day, for more than two. And there's the 90-day provision, because the face of the agreement states that it cannot be coerced. Because no extraordinary deference should be paid to the trial court for the same reason that this court identified in Lane versus Ergotis, which is there are only documents to look at. As in Lane versus Ergotis, and I apologize if I mispronounced the...
I never knew how to pronounce it either.
Okay. Well, but this is a straight issue of arbitrability. Now, this court made its decision without the benefit of the J.A. Walker case. And the J.A. Walker case goes a long way towards resolving this difficulty. In the J.A. Walker case, this court held that issues that go to the arbitrability, to the arbitration agreement specifically, are to be decided by the trial court after a hearing. And issues that go to the general context are to be decided by an arbitrator. In this case, that would mean on remand, the trial court would decide if Mr. Moffitt was coerced after a hearing. But if the issue is, what are the contents of the medical durable powers of attorney and the durable powers of attorney, that issue would have to be decided by an arbitrator, as I understand this court's holding. I can recap, or I can give you guys 27 seconds of vacation.
It's up to you.
Thank you.
The curious result invited by the argument you just heard is that a POA cannot enter, can enter but not rescind. Think about that as you think about this question, because one of you asked a very important question about Mr. Nemro suggested that you could just imply that the specification of who could rescind was just an add-on of some sort of general power for anyone in the world to rescind. I don't think that's true. And so you're being asked to conclude that the general power of attorney statute, which actually doesn't reach pre-dispute, permits entry of a pre-dispute arbitration, but not rescission.
Well, that, as I understand the argument, that would be answered by the 90-day ability of the holder of the POA and the fiduciary capacity to rescind without question, right?
Well, I mean, with respect, Justice Hobbs, I think that it may be that that power was put in to allow the exercise during the 90-day period for a person who suddenly became incapacitated and had time, and there was still time to rescind.
Well, I understand that's your argument, but if we don't buy that...
No, I understand.
What's the problem with that, saying that the power to rescind is with the power of whoever executed it in the power of attorney, because that was the signatory of the agreement.
Well, it comes back for me to the three points of voluntary, not rational at the time. They submitted an arbitration agreement in a prohibited situation, and they want now to eviscerate that statute by permitting any surrogate that they come up with a signature to be allowed to enter an arbitration agreement that the statute seems to be generally trying to prohibit, and that you're supposed to read in terms of the overall goal of voluntariness, and it must be read in relationship to the Rodriguez decision. That's our take on it. You've dealt with this before very firmly. I do want to say that this, you know, all the case law all over the country on entering medical durables, none of that applies because of the section we have in our state that makes it public policy to prohibit conditioning entry into health care on signing an arbitration agreement. It has to be legal in this state. It's not a complicated question in this state. You don't need to reach the panoply of the words necessary or the problems of what a medical power can do to see the statute prohibits.
Thank you.
Thank you.
On behalf of the council, thank all counsel for your arguments. The case stands submitted.